The Not Alone Podcast. I'm Sam Fredrickson.
And I'm Jason Moitoso, and quite confused. Sam, you doing okay over there?
I'm not, especially because now, recording our second episode of the Not Alone Podcast at a distance, we're back now, again.
Now that you all have had a week to digest and potentially research some supplemental information about Chapter 1 of the Book of the Law. What? So it's now April 9th, correct?
Is it? Today?
No.
Oh.
April okay. 9th, 1904.
No. Yes.
Getting the next transmission. So are we provoking ghosts then this week, Sam?
I wish. I will say that's one thing about living in Le Center, which is where I live now. There are more ghosts here. There are more ghosts here. No,
General
this
paranoia,
week.
Paranorma? No. Paranoia? There we go. That's the word.
No, I mean ghosts specifically. Okay. This week, we are talking about the second chapter of the Book of the Law, which is the manifestation of Hadit, or had it, as in I've had it. I'm shutting down the podcast.
Sam, if I had a dollar for every time you did that, I'd have like $10.
You'd have a lot of money over the last 3 years. No, had it is Nuit, as you remember, Nuit is Nut, the Egyptian sky manifestation. Had it is Nuts, Nuit's consort and opposite. Now, Nuit represents infinitely expansive space, the night sky. Had it, or Hadit, whatever, represents an infinitely contracted point. Hadit is also present on the Stele of Revealing, pointed out by Rose Kelly in the Egyptian Museum. There he was in his traditional form, which is the form of the winged solar disk. Now, this is interesting. Hadit is not like Nut, where Nut is a personality that is the sky. He is not like Horus, whereas Horus is a personality that is a god that resides, whose domain is the sky. Hadit is the winged solar disk, and this disk is a very interesting symbol that is much harder to pin down than either one of those two. Instead, it's been suggested that the winged solar disk is a prehistoric personification of the sun god Ra or the sun god Horus. But even more than that, and probably the impetus for Crowley's potential of seeing it and utilizing it here, as we will see, is that it has been thought to represent both royalty and divinity throughout the years. It's been found on kingly seals throughout the ancient Near East, obviously in Egypt, but also including those of King Hezekiah in Judah and other places. It is also a symbol for the soul, or eternity. And thus, it is a symbol, in Crowley's mind, for the divine self. It is ready-made for his mystical libertarianism that denotes the godhood of every man's eternal essence. So that's Hadit.
What?
What? That wasn't even anything. That was me just telling you about this.
My mind Jason, was melted from chapter one, Sam.
Buddy, oh my God.
You have
if
to
you
rebuild
can't handle
me.
That, dude, we got to figure something out, man. This is not good. That's all right. I'll just keep going here.
Yeah, just keep going. Just keep going. Got it.
Okay.
Son, people, royalty. Yeah, that makes sense. I'm following. I promise.
Okay. All right. Verse 3 of chapter 2 states, quote, "In the sphere I am everywhere the center, as she, the circumference, is nowhere found." So she, the circumference, expansive, limitless space, knew it. He, the center, infinite contraction of space, had it. In an infinite system, the universe, for instance, the universe doesn't have a center. Everywhere is the center, because everywhere you look out, you see in a radius, in a diameter, in the circumference, whatever.
No, you see it in radius.
You see the same amount of whatever coming in. We see 14.8 billion light years no matter which way we look. Thus, we are the center of the universe, and so is everything else, because the universe is infinite, or something like that. I don't even know how it works.
Yeah, that's more conceptually understandable.
Okay, good, good. So that would basically be that a planet is Hadit, kind of. The Hadit is the center of all things. We'll just stick with that. Crowley...
It's the perceived center.
It is right? Actual center.
Oh.
Which is everywhere because it's infinite. Everything, it is the actual center because everything is not as it is in our scientific reality where we have a perceived center, but probably an actual center maybe somewhere. It is that everywhere is literally the center and he is in and with all of it always. And yet is infinitely contracted into one single point. Crowley states that this evokes an old mystical definition of God. Quote, he whose center is everywhere and whose circumference is nowhere. However, in this system, there is one who is the circumference and one who is the center. But again, hearkening back to last episode, with its strict condemnation of duality and pluralism, it's not. It's still just one, no matter what. All right. Verse 22, I'm trying to fly through these ones. In verse 22, we get another hint as to how thelema was to be practiced and the true will discerned by that practice. It says, quote, I am the snake that giveth knowledge and delight and bright glory and stir the hearts of men with drunkenness. To worship me, take wine and strange drugs, whereof I will tell my prophet, and be drunk thereof. They shall not harm ye at all. It is a lie, this folly against self. The exposure of innocence is a lie. Be strong, O man. Lust, enjoy all things of sense and rapture. Fear not that any god shall deny thee for this. Unquote. So here we have Hadith telling us to take any kind of drug we want, and it's just not going to harm us.
Well, that's not true.
We could take... Well,
it's not medically true, but I don't know, on the infinite spiritual level.
On a spiritual level. It's probably also not true on that level. And I guess I misspoke. He does not say take every drug. He says take the drugs that my prophet says to take.
It would warp the person, not the eternal soul.
That's true. It would distort the coup, but not the cause.
Exactly.
Which, yeah, you are right.
The cobs is what matters, right? The coups don't particularly matter.
Yeah, the coups come and go, but cob is forever.
All I can think of is corn. But okay.
I know. Me too. Now, as he mentioned, he, Hadith, is identified with the serpent, and the serpent comes up time and time again in the Book of the Law, which makes sense, again, especially given his Judeo-Christian upbringing and the way that serpents obviously play a big role in that. Go back to the garden and you'd still get people who are like, oh, the serpent's the good guy because he's trying to bring light and knowledge and truth. And it's like, okay, so that's your interpretation of it, buddy. But in any case, that's not necessarily the serpent that is necessarily being invoked. It's not that it's not being invoked, because it definitely is. But Crowley is actually identifying a different religious philosophical character, not even a character, a different object in a different philosophy rather than Western Christian and Judeo-Christian thought. It is the concept of the Kundalini. Ooh. Do you know about the Kundalini, Jason?
No, sir. Tell me all about it.
Okay. Well, in the modern day, it means a lot of different things. Primarily because Crowley used it. Like, I don't know if everyone's seeing this yet. Most of the New Age philosophies, the way that the New Age like movement relies on Eastern philosophies, takes and uses like yoga for its own practices, tarot, meditation, all of this is traced back to Crowley introducing it to, like, he is the godfather of the New Age. And that's weird to say, because in that case it's true. Like, everything that he's saying is true. He is the man who changes the world, because he has, and it has. Wicca, New Age movements, all of this is traceable back to Aleister Crowley, as we'll hopefully see at one point. But sorry, a little bit off track there. The Kundalini specifically comes from it's a Sanskrit word. It is a Hindu concept, very important in actual like spiritual yoga and yogic practice. The Kundalini is, in thelema, the central magical force in mankind. In yoga, or sorry, in Hinduism, Kundalini is basically, again, just a divine force that is within mankind as well. So same kind of interpretation there, a little bit different. But Hadith, this point, this infinitely contracted point, the singularity within all things, is the source, or is Kundalini itself, is the opening. You've heard about chakras, right? We've all heard about chakras in rising. So basically, you hear like people talk about opening their chakras. Do you know what that means?
Each chakra flows into the other. When you're able to open one, you are... God, come on, think Jason, Avatar. You've watched this episode.
Did they have an episode about this on Avatar?
Yeah, yeah. Aang couldn't go into the Avatar state, and it was because he had a blockage and his chakras were unaligned.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And he had to go through a meditation system to basically realign all his chakras and become Zen again, essentially.
Avatar is so good.
So good.
So good.
Better than Adventure Time.
Well,
probably. Far, a distant mile. Okay.
That's fair. So yes, basically the chakras are different. They're essentially, especially when we're looking in this case, chakras are different gates that are within each human being. We have a certain number of them. The lowest one is in your hips and your pelvis, basically, which is where the Kundalini begins. Now, Kundalini, linguistically, like I said, it's a Sanskrit word meaning circular. It's also related to the word for snake, and thus it has been led to it being visualized as a coiled serpent that rests near the base of the spine. As you open your chakras, basically, that Kundalini energy begins at the base of your spine and moves up and up and up and up. And as it passes through each one of those chakras, which are opened, and which the opening of it precipitates it, its upwards movement, or not precipitates, but you know what I mean, presupposes its upward movement, as it then reaches the crown chakra, which should sound familiar because we talked about the crown Sephiroth in Kabbalah, and of course Crowley has fused these systems together. As it reaches that crown, then you enter into a different kind of consciousness completely. You, for lack of a better like word, are transformed, at least from a consciousness perspective, into a different kind of being. And that is essentially what Crowley is trying to get at here, is that the discovery of the true will is the same metaphor or actual reality, one or the other, as the aligning of the chakras, as the great work of alchemy, as dying and going to heaven, as perpetual rebirth until the attainment of nirvana. These are all the same thing. And Kundalini is what he is using to explain the magical force of man that is naturally blocked and through the practice of Thelema will become unblocked until the consciousness is transformed. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Nice.
Don't ask me to repeat it.
No, that's fine. I'm actually learning a lot because these are like words that I've heard in different, just like in passing, and especially because we do like a lot of paranormal stuff. Especially on these like websites where I'm researching, I'll see different things. I've never really understood any of it before. So it's really quite interesting. This is an aside, but I ordered my own yoga mat and I have my own yoga mat now and I'm going to do yoga. I'm not going to be a yogi. I would just like to be able to touch my toes. That is my goal.
Sam, just do some light stretching for a bit.
There we go. All right. So the ascension of the Kundalini energy...
It'll help your balance, though, too. That's important.
I fall over all the time for no reason.
I've seen it. I just thought you stood up too quick.
No, dude, all the time. And most of the time I walk into a room, it's a 1 in 4 chance that I'm just going to fall over for no reason.
Strange vertigo there, bud.
Yeah, it's rough. Again, Kundalini, moving upwards, charges individuals with power that has been described as akin to an electric shock. And produces transformation of consciousness along the way. According to one Swami, quote, super sensual visions appear before the mental eye of the aspirant. New worlds with indescribable wonders and charms unfold themselves before the yogi. Planes after planes reveal their existence and grandeur to the practitioner, and the yogi gets divine knowledge, power, and bliss in increasing degrees when Kundalini passes through chakra after chakra, making them bloom in all their glory. Now, according to our boy Carl Jung, he says, quote, the concept of Kundalini has for us only one use, that is to describe our own experiences with the unconscious. The opening of the Kundalini and accessing of its power could be yet another metaphor, like I said, for the manifestation of the alchemical great work, the central tenet of the Lama, which involves the discovering, the pursuit of the true will, and the changing of lead into gold. It's all connected.
Naturally.
In this system, at least. Naturally. All right. All right. All right. Now, pursuant back to the idea of true will, Hadith has a big problem. A big problem. Like, a violent problem.
Is this just going to contradict book one or chapter one?
No, it doesn't. I think it actually does a very good job of, like, illuminating more of what is meant by it. He has a big problem with the word because. So, but
he has a problem with explaining things?
Not necessarily, although I think he probably does. He has an issue, a philosophical moral issue with because. Because tries to explain why things happen, right? That's kind of the core idea behind that word.
Right.
Yet, if we go back to that philosophy behind the Tao, which is, I believe, the philosophy behind true will, things happen. I was about to say things happen because they happen that way, but that's not even it. It is simply that things happen. So verses 28 through 31 state, quote, now a curse upon because and his kin. May because be accursed forever. If will stops and cries why, invoking because, then will stops and does not. If power asks why, then power is weakness. So
break that down for me. I don't know why, but I'm not catching along here.
That's okay. So basically, we think that there is a reason as to why things happen. And this goes back again to this idea of the contrast between the will and your destiny or fate. Fate happens for a specific, it is literally that things happen for a specific reason, right? This happened because that happened, and this is happening now so that something else can happen in the future. When we're looking at true will, things do not have an internal reason. Crowley's comment states, there is no reason why a star should continue in its orbit. Let her rip. Every time the conscious acts, it interferes with the subconscious, which is Hadith. It is the voice of man and not a god. Any man who listens to reason ceases to be a revolutionary, unquote. There is this irony of his providing a comment at all, trying to find the reason and the logic behind the words, which would seem to say that there is no reason in logic, but what we're looking at here is that it eschews even the basest understanding of God as the reason or the logic of reality. Things do not happen because of anything. Things happen. That's very different to our causal, like, temporally bound chain and effect or cause and effect thing. Like, this happened because that happened. With Crowley, everything is happening. There is no initial cause, which I think, again, is his way of very harshly breaking from the religious and philosophical systems that he has been exploring all of this time, because the typical universally agreed upon definition of God for anyone either philosophically or religiously minded that I think everyone can agree with is that God is that which starts everything, or God is that which is behind everything. God is what is there when nothing else is. If you go down this chain of cause and effect, right, there's the Kalam cosmological argument, which states that anything that happens happens because there is a cause, and therefore the universe has happened, and therefore there is a cause to the universe, and then there is God. That's this philosophical argument that's been going around since the, like, 800s or whatever. But what Crowley is saying is that is fundamentally untrue. There is no cause. There is only effect.
What?
Yeah.
There's nothing. There is no reason behind things.
There's no reason
there
behind anything.
Just events.
When one sits, I, as he says here, every time the conscious acts, it interflows or it interferes with the subconscious. So, are you familiar with like flow, the flow state?
No.
Okay. All right. The flow state is this thing that like basically it is often reported by athletes. It happened to me one time in my life and it was amazing when I was a barista at Dutch Bros. Basically what it is that you do not think, you just act, and you do the exact right thing every time. You are essentially living on intuition before you even have anything to intuit. You are simply
Sam, I hate to tell you this, but that was just muscle memory.
No, it's not muscle memory. That's the thing. Muscle memory is like, because how long can you have something that is muscle memory? Like maybe a few seconds, maybe a minute or two. You can't have muscle memory going for 2 hours interrupted, right?
When you're just kind of on autopilot, you mean?
Yeah, on autopilot, but on autopilot and getting 100% on every test. Have you ever seen, you're not on TikTok, are you?
No.
Yet?
Lord,
still?
No.
Okay.
I'm on there Reddit, which means I can't be on TikTok.
That's fair. There are these amazing videos on TikTok where people basically, I don't even know how to describe it. I'll try to link to one in the show notes. Basically, they dance. And like as they dance, you'll see from the corners, like their face will come in and like their face will move in. So imagine a person dancing and then from the right side of the screen, the face moves in towards the center and then it aligns with their face. And it aligns and they're making the face and it's in the right space at just the right time, basically. And then they do it with their arms and their legs. And you're basically seeing the individual parts of the dance that they then move. It appears as though they're moving into the correct positions as if it's some sort of a game in order to match their body or their face to that which is coming to them. But in reality, they have simply done the dance.
Like DDR?
Kind of like DDR. It's very specific DDR. But DDR is actually, I think, exactly what I'm trying to get at here. Basically.
It's not letting yourself overthink the action. You are just
doing the action.
It
is simply doing. It is simply doing. Every time the conscious acts, every time you sit and you think, you are interfering with the subconscious, which is, according to Crowley, which is Hadith, which is that which is behind the true will. DDR is the right answer to this because if you sit and you think about DDR, you're going to lose at DDR. But if you just feel it and you kind of keep your eye on the screen and feel the music, you just do it. It just works. When you do the thing and you do it right and you don't mess it up, it just
right,
works.
It's like Guitar Hero.
Guitar Hero. This is essentially true will is just like this.
Okay,
it is,
I'm following.
That for all of your life, in every moment of your life.
Lovely.
Thelema is DDR.
Boom. Wrap it up. We're done here. That is chapter 2.
I have been slightly paranoid.
Thank you, everyone, for tuning in.
We still have chapter 3, even if we were done with chapter 2, which we're not. I have been slightly paranoid that someone's going to cast a spell on me this entire series, and if me saying that Thelema is basically Dance Dance Revolution doesn't do it, then I think I'm invincible. I think I'm good to go. Anyway, does that help? Does
yes,
that make...
I am following okay. now.
Good.
I mean, come on. I made another comparison right there. So, yeah, I'm following.
You got
I'm getting it.
You got it. All right. All right. All right. All right. All right. All right.
Oh, boy. For anyone that doesn't play video games, I don't know how
I don't
to help
know
you.
What to tell you.
I don't.
I'm sorry. Music, yeah, piano, playing guitar, not even just like Guitar Hero. Those are other great examples of like when you just do it. You're just in it. You're just living it.
Right.
You
you're,
don't
just,
play,
you're not overthinking the actions.
Yeah. You don't
you're
play like the next.
Psyching yourself out.
You don't play the next note because it's the right note to play. You just play the next note. So that's what Hadith
is. Oh no,
is
I've never gotten that
here.
Good at.
Oh,
at Guitar Hero. So I don't know what to tell you.
Well, no, I'm talking about actually like writing music.
I played
like, making...
Freebird like probably a quarter dozen times, but like, oof, nope.
All right. So the Unity. Okay, the Unity. the unity that flows between the four forces of nature, the unity which drives our hydrological and geological cycles. There is no reason to the unity. It simply is unity. The unity is the reason. All right. Now, when one is acting in will, they simply are. They do not sit and think and plan and scheme and determine. They dance through reality. I wrote that before the DDR thing, so I must have known what was coming. They dance through reality in the rhythm of their subconscious, unconscious, dispensing with the veiled reality of concepts and things that we move between, and instead simply flow through time and space like a river, like a star orbiting a black hole, Hadith. Now.
So do you Hadith, actually have free will?
Yeah. Your will is completely free because it is not conditioned by because.
But is it still my will, or is it the will?
That's the mystery.
That is acting on me still.
It is the will that is acting on you that
but
you
it's not my
are,
will.
But it is your will.
But it's an external.
This is very well summed up in the Thalamic concept. I actually didn't put it in here because I didn't think we were going to talk about it yet. It's very important, but we were going to talk about it later. But basically, it's the Thalamic concept of the Holy Guardian Angel, okay? The Holy Guardian Angel is basically a manifestation of the will. In Aleister Crowley's case, his Holy Guardian Angel is AWAS. It is the being that he channeled in order to write this publication, to write this book. He is subjected to it, but it is himself that he is subjected to. He is the one delivering this to himself. And that's where we're in the mystery zone again.
Oh, goody. Okay.
The point of Thelema is to discover your Holy Guardian Angel. People name it. Or if they don't name it, if they haven't discovered it, they explicitly do not name it and just refer to it as the HGA or the Holy Guardian Angel, to become in tune with it and then to listen to it and not to question it. But it
well,
is still themselves. Yeah, I know. Exactly. You're out. You're gone. That's okay. Maybe in your next life. Who knows? Who knows? Now, the second chapter introduces a few components of rituals. Like I mentioned last episode, there are certain feasts that are supposed to be held at certain times. Interestingly, though, in verse 55, it states, quote, "Thou shalt obtain the order and value of the English alphabet. Thou shalt find new symbols to attribute them unto," unquote. Remember, last episode, last chapter, we learned that with the occurrence of the equinox of the gods, all of the different religious philosophical systems of Earth were obsolete and new ones had to be created. When we look at those, especially magical systems, they are predominantly written in non-English languages. They are in Hebrew, in Greek, in Latin. What Hadith is saying here is that Thelema is going to be an English religion, basically. It's going to be the English alphabet will be raised to the same level of divinity as the Hebrew, Greek, and Latin. Well, the Roman alphabet's the same, but anyway, the Hebrew and Greek alphabets.
Okay.
It does not mean that there will be no Hebrew and Greek, but it means that there will be more Roman characters in this than not. So, okay. All right, we're good?
Yes.
Okay, final chapter.
Wait, that was already chapter two?
Last bit. That was chapter two.
It, wow.
Like I said, yeah, see?
All right, so
just
chapter summary.
Off. Chapter summary, there is Hadith. Hadith is the infinitely contracted point. Hadith wants you to simply act and to simply be and to speak English. That is what Hadith wants.
So
one last thing. Oh, go ahead.
And as far as acting goes, it's more closer to like instinctual.
It's complete and unfiltered intuition.
Okay.
It is, you do not know why you're doing things because you don't need a reason to do why, other than it is what you are doing. You're just basically
flowing as the stream.
You are flowing. You are simply reacting. Actually, I was going to say you are simply acting, but I think it is more that you are simply reacting. You are not sitting and saying, oh, I'm going to make this plan and do this and that. Like, something happens and you react to it and that's it. There is no intermediary. It is, as we're going to see here at the beginning of chapter three, it is another way for talking about the unity and discovering that which is beyond what is before and after, but rather what is eternally now. So that's what we're about to talk about.
Okay. So
now the last
three.
Thing, really quick, oh, last thing oh, about Hadid, oh. Okay. is that Hadid. So we talked about the coup and the cobs. Remember which is which?
The cobs is the eternal self. The coup is the persona we put on. Yeah.
Yep. It's the temporal self. Behind the cobs is Hadid. Okay. So Hadid is in the cobs, which is in the coup. And then there are actually more stages beyond that, basically. But, or even further the other way. Hadid is the end and the beginning. Then there's a whole nother side of the spectrum. But just keep in mind that basically the way it works is Hadid, as the infinitely contracted point, is essentially the fountain of all being. Then, from that fountain, your cobs, your holy guardian angel, is a refraction of that fountain. And then your coup, or yourself, is a refraction of your holy guardian angel, which is a refraction of Hadid. So we are all Hadid. We are all the same. We are all united. We are all one. Okay?
Following.
Unity.
Okay.
Unity. And that's really important when we look at the final chapter, the Book of the Law. It's Sam here with the mid-show break. I've just got a few people to thank. The first few are just people who donated to our Patreon and signed up to become regular donators and supporters of the show. So we would just like to thank Anne-Marie York. We'd like to thank Anne-Marie York, Lady Wisely, Jasper, and Callie Johnson. Thank you guys so much for donating to the show. It really, really means a lot to us. The other thing that really helps out the show is leaving a 5-star review on iTunes. And so we'd like to thank Woo Meter, Kekara Kekara, and Boys Hack for leaving those 5-stars reviews. And we'll just read Boys Hack. They just say, enjoyable, love the show, keep it up. Thank you guys so much for all of your support. All right, with no further ado, let's get back to the show. Chapter 3, which opens with a magical word. The word is described...
Now, this is also someone else delivering it, correct?
Yes.
A third entity?
Okay. Yes, and we're...
And on the next day.
Yes, it's the next day, and the entity this time is Ra-Hor-Kuat, who again is a manifestation of Horus. So I'm really just going to call him Horus. That's what we're going to do. So the last two... They opened with basically saying, oh crap, let me see. Just one second here. Let me get back to my copy of the Book of the Law. So the first one opens by saying, chapter one opens by saying, had the manifestation of knew it. Okay. The second chapter opens by saying, knew the hiding of Hadid. So these two are connected, had and knew, Hadid and knew it. So they're connected in order to make the whole. They're basically kind of like the backdrop of where everything happens and takes place. But chapter three does not begin with any sort of an invocation, because technically knew it invokes had in order to be revealed, and had is hidden by knew it in order to reveal had, Hadid, whatever. Anyway, chapter three starts with the magical word. The word of the eon, abrahadabra, abrahadabra.
Isn't there a song about that?
Is there?
Abra, abracadabra.
See, you're saying abracadabra.
Yeah.
Abracadabra.
I'm following. Yes.
Abracadabra is what we've all heard it a million times. It's what stage magicians say. It's just a word. But abrahadabra is a little bit different. Okay.
What does that mean?
Yeah. Now, first, let me tell you what abracadabra means.
Oh, okay, that makes sense.
Okay, because it's important. Okay, so we've talked about Abracadabra at least once before. For anyone who missed it, it is not just the random mumbo-jumbo that a stage magician says before performing a trick. In fact, the incantation has been around since at least the 2nd century AD, where it was prescribed as a treatment for malaria, which is ironic because Crowley had malaria all the time. The treatment was that the afflicted should wear a triangular amulet, which begins with Abracadabra at the top. Then, as it goes down each line, it takes away one letter per line until it finally just ends at the point of the triangle with A. Okay? This is a magical amulet that people used in Rome and all throughout history, basically, to ward off sickness. Okay?
Yep.
It achieved particularly widespread usage.
Did it work?
Well, now that's the question, isn't it? You would think so. It was the earliest mention we have of it is from a physician's notebook, basically. He was a physician to the Caesars, and he was like, just do this and you'll be fine. So maybe it worked. Maybe it didn't. Jason probably thinks it didn't. Who knows? Now,
no. Why would
it achieved... It achieved widespread usage during the Great Plague of London in 1665 through 66, in which 100,000 people died in 18 months, as opposed to the Great Plague of 2020, wherein 180,000 people have died in 3 months. So there's that. Maybe it's about time for it to make a resurgence. Now, Crowley changed the spelling from abracadabra to abrahadabra. Firstly, the reason he did this is because this is how the word was spelt in the ceremonies of the Golden Dawn. But the reason why that spelling is changed is because this causes the numerical value of the word to add to 418. 418.
Why does that matter?
Well, I'm glad you asked. I spent about 2 hours researching, and I still don't know. But I think I've got something here, okay? So let's just, as we've done so many times before, just roll with me, okay?
Just what I have to do.
Just hear me out, okay?
I hear ya.
418. Okay. Essentially, a huge part of the Book of the Law, Thelema, Kabbalah, all of this that we've avoided talking about in depth, like I mentioned last, or I think two episodes ago now, is numerology, okay? Numerological fever dreams that baffle the hell out of me that I don't understand, even though I can acknowledge that they're interesting and I'd like to understand them, but they're beyond me, which is not something I say lightly. The process in Hebrew is referred to as gematria. It's a very simple process. I mean, it's simple in its philosophy or its theory. Basically, in Hebrew, as I'm sure we've mentioned before, each letter is also a number, okay? So the first 10 letters of the alphabet correspond to the numbers 1 through 10. The next 9, or I guess the first 9 correspond from 1 through 9. The next 9 correspond for 10 through 90, going up by intervals of 10 each time. And then the next 10 correspond to 100 through, or the next 9 correspond to 100 through 900, going up by 100 every time. This means that every single word is a number. For instance, one of the most famous gematrias is the word for life, which is chai, like l'chaim. Chai has a numerological equivalent of 18, okay? If you take the chet and the yod, chet is the 8th letter, yod is the 10th, and so it forms 18. So this then works itself out in the real world and has a practical effect in which those who are interested in Orthodox or even not Orthodox, but simply observant Jews, 18 is a big number in their lives. For instance, when they give a gift of money, typically the gift of money is going to be a multiple of 18. Okay, so that's kind of how this works out in the real world, okay?
Okay.
All right. Now, by Crowley's reckoning, abrahadabra is the pronunciation of the number 418 if written in Hebrew.
Yeah.
He calls...
But...
Go ahead.
So why did he... feels like cheating is what it feels
why?
Like. Because you're replacing a letter in order to make it the correct number that you want it to be.
Okay. What's your point? That's how it works, baby. That's okay. How numerology works.
All right, whatever.
You get to the number you need.
Yeah, okay. So why does the number matter, not the word?
Well, they both matter. Exactly. They both matter very much. Together, they matter. I can't answer questions. I just got to keep going because like I said, I don't even understand this.
Okay, fair enough.
This is just the little bit after 2 hours that I was able to grasp. Okay.
Lovely.
So Crowley's reckoning, abrahadabra, the pronunciation of 418. We'll get to why it's an H instead of a C because he has a reason for that. The pronunciation of 418, what he calls the word of the eon, which represents the great work complete. Now, the great work. We've talked about the great work. What is the great work? Jason?
Can I phone a friend?
Jason? Magnus opus? Nothing? Okay. Damn, son. Alchemy.
Oh.
My
brain
sorry.
Is fried. We talked about
I needed
about this
you to
already.
Think back like a whole 15 episodes to our series on alchemy. I apologize. Alchemy. The creation of the philosopher's stone is the great work.
There is no self. There's only headache.
The creation of the philosopher's stone is a metaphor. It is a metaphor for the union with God. It is a metaphor for the dissolution of the objective into the subjective, into object, into subject, until a new form of seeing and being is attained. It is the goal of Thelema. It is the communion with the holy guardian angel. Abrahadabra is also 11 letters, which is formulated by Crowley as the addition of 5 and 6. 5 represents the pentagram, a 5-pointed star which represents the microcosm, the known world, made up of 4 elements, fire, air, water, and earth, which are presided over by a 5th crown point of spirit, Malkuth, the lowest point on the Kabbalistic tree of life, the interlay of the physical with the material. The pentagram is an essential symbol for Thelema and all magic, really. It is, I mean, you know a pentagram. We've all seen a pentagram at this point.
It's a star.
And you probably thought we were going to be talking about pentagrams 7 episodes ago because it's like fundamental to all of this.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, exactly. And yet here we are on episode 8 talking about pentagrams. So basically it is used in what is called the lesser ritual of the pentagram, in which the formation of the shape in the air is made by use of a magic wand and is used to either invoke or to banish something to and from a space. Okay. Pentagram, 5, the microcosm.
So hexagram is the macrocosm.
Oh my God. You got it. You're getting
wow.
it. You're
wow,
magically thinking. I'm so proud of you.
Deductive reasoning.
The hexagram is a 6-pointed star, known to most of us as a Star of David, is what we would think of it as, which represents the macrocosm. Its 6 points represent Saturn, Jupiter, Mars, the Sun, Venus, Mercury, and the Moon. When mapped onto the Tree of Life, these points overlay with 6 of the Sephiroth, but bestowing these planetary associations to them as well. The hexagram is also the unification of the alchemical symbols for fire, which is a triangle, and an inverted triangle, which is the alchemical symbol for water, and thus represents the unification of the opposites. Thus, abrahadabra is the unification of the microcosm, abra, and the macrocosm, hadabra. Or not
wow.
hadabra, sorry, adabra. However, that interpretation, what I just said, abra and adabra, which I got simply from the 5 and the 6,
right?
It betrays the idea that the microcosm and the macrocosm are different. Okay.
I'm following.
It thinks that there's a difference between those. Therefore, that's why 1 is 5, 1 is 6, it's unbalanced. You see, it's unbalanced. Okay. Now, the creation or the completion of the great work is not to nullify the self, but to transform it by taking all of the subjective and the objective onto the self and becoming a different thing entirely. Abrahadabra goes back to the fundamental characteristic of balancing, the fundamental idea of balancing, which is, well, it's fundamental, obviously, to the alchemical work, which is the work of Thelema, which is the work of the mystics, which is the work of the unification, which is everything, which is Kundalini energy, which is everything. as above and so below.
Son of a gun.
It should
You've
not,
done it.
It should not be. I've brought it all around. It should not be Abra and Adabra being unified. That's not the right way to think of it. Instead, we need to think of it as Abra had Abra. Abra is the microcosm, had, and then Abra is the macrocosm. See, the two realms of above and below are mirrors of each other, which necessitates a point of union between them, above what and below what. There must be something in the midst. And if we take that equation and change it from a vertical to a horizontal orientation, we might read in it instead, so in the west as in the east, or so to the left as to the right. But again, if we accept the truth of this statement, which is that at its core, such distinctions are in fact meaningless, instead, we should just say, as this is this, or Abra had Abra. Had sits in the middle of two identical pairs of syllables. Had is Hadit. It is the central point. Before Hadit is Abra, after Hadit is Abra. Above Hadit is above, below Hadit is below. And Abrahadabra, the word and the numerological concept, is the unification of these two things. Hadit, the fire of eternity, which burns within us in all of creation, makes all things balanced. And their balancing does not, as we've seen from the very first chapter, does not mean that 1 plus 1 equals 2, or even that 1 minus 1 equals 0, but rather that negative 1 and 1 together equal 0. They cancel each other out. And in doing so, the unification of these opposites, the unification creates something that both was there before and wasn't there before. You see, when we look at Hadit, the winged solar disk, it would often be accompanied by two uraeuses, which are the serpents atop the headdresses of the pharaohs and the gods in Egyptian myth, flanked on either side by one facing the left and one facing the right, one devouring the past and the other devouring the future, one eating the beginning and one eating the end, because the only reality is now. The now is infinite, it is eternal, it cannot be transgressed, not because we are restricted by the serpents of the gods. They devour the past and the future in order to feed the now. 418 represents nothingness. It is the result of the unification of opposites. Earlier in the Book of the Law, Nuit says that her number is 8, 80, and 61. These, depending on your system, all add up to the numerological equivalence of the word nothingness. Thus, 418 also represents nothingness. It is the key to Thelema. The unification of opposites does not create something new. It cancels out division and it returns us to unity, which is something new to us. Does that make sense? It's okay to say no.
Yes, I'm following.
Okay, so that is Abrahadabra.
Cool.
All of that is that one word. And with that in mind, we can now move on to verse 2 of chapter 3. What does verse 2 say, you ask? I hear you asking.
Nothing.
You're crying.
Nothing.
You're crying for it.
It
you want it.
It says, disregard verse 1.
Verse 1 is a lie.
Yep. That's
and verse 2.
What I'm
and
going
verse
with.
1 says verse 2 is a lie. There we go. All right. Verse 2 says, quote, there is a division hither homeward. There is a word not known. Spelling is defunct. All is ought. All is not ought. Beware and hold, unquote. So basically, that's just saying that no matter what, we're not going to understand it, and talking about it's pointless. So, boop, 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 boop.
So here's this information. Don't worry about what it means. It's pointless. It doesn't matter because I'm assuming it's not the will, or it does not impact the will.
Oh, no, it's the entire point of everything.
But don't worry about it.
Don't worry about it. You can't understand it through words. That's what it's trying to say.
Right, right.
So, and again, to read you verse 1 again, because I know
nope,
I
nope,
added a lot to
don't,
it. No,
don't
no,
have
no,
to.
Let me just read it to you. Quote, Abrahadabra, the reward of Ra Hor Kut. That's all verse 1 is.
What?
Unquote. That's all
what?
It is.
What?
And yet everything I just said
That was some English teacher reading between the lines there, bud.
The door is blue because we are all going to die one day and nothing matters. So, anyway. So,
no offense to any English teachers out there.
Basically, it doesn't matter how well you can explain this because this is not something that can be understood through words. It's something that has to be experienced. That's the idea, okay? Now, who are we talking to? Or who's talking to us? It's Horus. Knock, knock, who's there? It's Horus. He ascended to the throne of the gods at equinox. The revelation of himself, which is what this chapter is, will set the stage for what the next few hundreds or thousands of years of human history will be like, okay? Isis, Osiris, Horus. The character and nature of these gods was reflected in the character and nature of humankind as they followed these gods. So, Horus, let's see it. What is it, okay? You want to hear what he has to say about himself?
Sure do.
Quote, I am a god of war and vengeance. I shall Perfect. Deal hardly. Choose ye an island, fortify it, dung it about with enginery of war, and I will give you a war engine. With it ye shall smith the peoples. I think that's supposed to say smite. Smite the peoples, and none shall stand before you. Unquote. So.
Well, that's interesting, seeing it's the beginning of the 20th century.
Yep. And here's the thing. It sounds pretty violent, and there's a lot of violence in this chapter. For instance, here's what he says in the next, I think it's the next verse or a few other. It says, quote, thou shalt have danger and trouble. Horus is with thee. Worship me with fire and blood. Worship me with sword and spears. Let the woman be girt with a sword before me. Let blood flow unto my name. Trample down the heathen. Be upon them, O warrior. I give you of their flesh to eat. Sacrifice cattle, which is what it calls non-Thelemites, cattle. Sacrifice cattles, little and big, after a child. Unquote. So it does sound quite violent.
That's exciting.
Doesn't it? It does sound quite violent. And yet.
Now we have a god that is telling him what to do. That's a
Exactly.
We now have a we god. Have actionable things. That's so
we do
exciting.
Have actionable items, which, again, A, is completely counterintuitive to the idea of Thelema in general.
What?
And B, it's the whole of the law is love and not restricting others. So how can we possibly have this be the age of war and the age of all of this? Okay, so that's the question. What's your answer to the question?
Blood sacrifice.
Okay, see, that's the wrong answer.
What? Oh.
The right answer is to say that this is not talking literally. It is talking metaphorically about the way that the individual needs to find himself an island, the island being Thelema, and to entrench themselves in it and to fortify it. And to not allow anything to take them away from the island or anyone to invade it or anything. It's all a metaphor.
That's not what it sounds like to me.
No, it doesn't. But when it talks about worshiping with blood and fire, it simply means burning down the taboo, burning down the religious sensibilities. It simply means to really, really just destroy the ideological way of the heathen, which is all of us, but of course don't actually kill them and don't subjugate them to your will. Okay?
Okay.
All right, good.
Aye, Captain.
It could also be advocating actual murder, and here's the thing. We talked about it. Thelema is all about like, oh, well, you have to discover it for yourself. No one can tell you what it means. And so I don't see why no one can tell me what it means, but they can tell me that it absolutely doesn't mean killing other people. Okay, so
well, that goes against Thelema.
That goes against their interpretation of Thelema. That goes against their interpretation of Thelema. But what if I interpreted it differently? You see? So that's the thing. All right. Okay.
Legit to me.
We're almost there, guys, I promise.
What? No.
I spent most of my time on Abrahadabra, and that's the majority of this. So there's just a few other things. First, chapter 3. Okay.
Okay.
One interesting thing that it talks about is it tries to fortify Horus tries to fortify Crowley and the Scarlet Woman, who again at this point is Rose, letting them know that something very bad is going to happen to them, but that Nuit and Hadit will take care of them. Horus will strengthen them, and therefore they don't need to worry. Crowley is also advised to acquire the Stele of Revealing, again, the slab of rock that's inscribed with the hieroglyphics that kicked off this entire thing. He's supposed to buy it and set it up for a ceremony of adoration. I think he actually does it. He's got the money for it. Then, another of the most important ceremonial components of Thelema, which is pretty explicit, and so it's kind of gross, and so you might want to skip ahead like 5 minutes if you're with kids or you just don't want... Basically.
Can I do that?
Yeah, go to sleep.
All right, cool.
Sleep. Basically, there is a recipe for what are known as the Cakes of Light. These are essentially the Thelemic interpretation of the Eucharist, and that makes me want to throw up. All right, here's the verse. Quote, "For perfume, mix meal and honey and thick leavings of red wine, then oil of abramelin and olive oil, and afterward soften and smooth down with rich fresh blood. The best blood is of the moon, monthly, then the fresh blood of a child, or dropping from the host of heaven, then of enemies, then of the priest or of the worshippers, last of some beast, no matter what. This burn. Of this make cakes, and eat unto me. This hath also another use. Let it be laid before me, and kept thick with perfumes of your orison. It shall become full of beetles, as it were, and creeping things, sacred unto me. I love bugs," that's what he says. So, basically, we're making a cake. What goes in the cake? Flour, honey, leavings of red wine, which I looked up as basically you boil the red wine until it's like a sticky, syrupy substance. The oil of abramelin, which is a component of the ritual of abramelin that Crowley at this point still has not achieved. And then some sort of blood. Menstrual blood is best. If you don't have that, the blood of a child, or of angels, or of your enemies, or of fellow Thelemites. And then if you can't get any of those, you can just take any sort of animal and get blood from that. Now, here's the other problem. And by problem, I do mean problem. Is that Crowley... In all of his, almost all of his writings, blood is a euphemism for semen. So, yeah, if Why? It wasn't gross enough already. So, I've done a lot of research on this, unfortunately. Basically.
I do not want to know what kind of ads you get on Google.
Basically, the way it works is that there is one cake that is made typically... with one drop of blood, not anything else. The blood is typically one drop of menstrual blood of the high priestess officiating it's called the Gnostic Mass, officiating the Mass. Now, that cake is then baked, burned into ashes, and those ashes are used to make other cakes that don't have those ingredients in them. So on a sanitation and hygienic level, it's probably fine. On a more fundamental level, it's absolutely not fine.
And you're ruining cake.
You're ruining cake.
You're putting ash in cake. That cannot be good.
And again, this is like Christians take communion. This is basically their communion. And that's why it makes me feel so bad inside to talk about it. So... there's that. In any case, it is used as an offering very similar, like I said, to the Eucharist, to unify the creator and the created, with flesh acting as the mediator. This is still used in pretty much every Thelemic Gnostic Mass to this day. So that's the other most important thing that happens in chapter 3, is that fundamental of ritual. Now there's just one or two left. In verse 42, we get the idea that Thelemites are not supposed to proselytize. They do not go around knocking on doors. They do not print pamphlets. Basically, they are supposed to, well, it says, quote, "Success is thy proof. Argue, convert not, talk not over much." So, basically, you can talk about it, but you're not there to convince anybody. It either works and it doesn't. If it works, people are going to be interested and they're going to ask you about it. Which is important because that is one of the fundamental steps of Thelema. Just like it's a fundamental steps of joining the Masons, people have to ask you about it. You don't really get to just invite people in willy-nilly. And they're only going to do that if they are successful. Does that track?
Yes.
All right. So the last part of the book that I think is really interesting from a biological or a biographical perspective is Horace basically issues a warning to the Scarlet Woman. Okay. It says, quote, "Let the Scarlet Woman beware. If pity and compassion and tenderness visit her heart, if she leave my work to toy with old sweetnesses, then shall my vengeance be known. I will slay me her child. I will alienate her heart. I will cast her out from men. As a shrinking and despised harlot shall she crawl through dusk wet streets and die cold and ahungered. But let her raise herself in pride. Let her follow me in my way. Let her work the work of wickedness. Let her kill her heart. Let her be loud and adulterous. Let her be covered in jewels and rich garments, and let her be shameless before all men. Then will I lift her to pinnacles of power. Then will I breed from her a child mightier than all the kings of the earth. I will fill her with joy. With my force shall she see and strike at the worship of Nu. She shall achieve Hadit." So, the Scarlet Woman, as long as she does not get all feely about things and doesn't allow her conscience and her morality back into play at any point in this equation, will be rewarded by giving birth to the Antichrist. If she fails...
Wait, isn't he the Antichrist?
He is a type of the Antichrist, but he is not the actual Antichrist. And that's another important aspect of Thelema, is it is unfulfilled. It is waiting for its full fulfillment. And
don't
that
you love prophecies?
I love them. And that can be either fulfilled individually by each individual person. They can be the fulfillment. Or there can be an actual anti-Messiah that is a parody of the actual Messiah. So you've got that going on as well, which seems to indicate that since we know the woman is the consort of the beast, that Crowley, his will is to produce the actual Antichrist. That is what his aim is going to be for the rest of his life. So there's that. Now, verses 50 through 55 include explicit blasphemy of every god that Crowley could think of, and I'm simply not going to quote them here. As we come to the close of the book, we are reminded that there is no law beyond do what thou wilt, so long as what thou wilt is not to esteem typical gods as gods. You can pretty much do anything other than worship something else, and of course restrict others. And Horace lays out the pattern for four different ordeals, rituals by which one moves into higher levels of knowledge and power. He says, anyone who says that the Book of the Law isn't beautiful, even if they don't understand it, is a liar. And then it ends with the word of the eon, abracadabra. And thus the Book of the Law is closed. So
all of this isn't incredibly ritualistic. I mean, towards the end you've got some.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not talking about unlocking powerful magics. It's not talking about ascending. It's again more like a philosophical. It's not like a grimoire of power summonings and stuff like that.
Right.
Like it's completely different than what I would initially have expected something like this would be.
So that good. I'm glad. So, or maybe I'm not glad, but yes. Okay. And it's important to recognize how scripture, especially in the systems that Crowley grew up in, how scripture functions. Essentially, in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, there is a central text of scripture. I do not want emails about this. I understand. I get what you're coming from, but I'm just telling you how it works, people. There is a central core text of scripture. That core text for the Jews is the first five books of the Hebrew Bible, the Torah. For the Christians, it is the four Gospels. And for Islam, it is the Quran. Each one of these books of scripture are then interpreted through other books of scripture, some which are canonized, like, for instance, Paul's letters in the New Testament, or like the prophets of the Old Testament and the biblical histories and the wisdom literature, or, for instance, in the case of the Quran, you have a book which is not scripture necessarily, but which is held to quite a high standard, which is called the Hadith, which is the sayings of the prophet, where basically the prophet expounds upon what is in the what is in the Quran itself. So you basically have your core of scripture, and then the rest of scripture is commentary on top of it. So following that pattern, essentially, the Book of the Law is the core mystical religious text from which all things are extrapolated. But you're correct in saying that it does not actually hold the detailed instructions or meanings of these things in and of themselves. Those will come through other Thelemic works that Crowley has yet to write at this point. It is through those that he discovers the rituals, he understands, you know, the little, he talks about these four different ordeals, so he's going to figure out what those ordeals are, figure out the, Horace talks about giving them machinery, or not machinery, enginery, to do war in order to win, basically. That enginery is going to be the sex magic that Crowley extrapolates from this. But exactly, you're exactly right. It does not have the explicit instructions in how to perform these rituals and these actions, because that's how religion works. Religion grows out of a response to a revelation. There's a revelation first, and then a system of action grows out of response to it. So that's what we're going to be looking at for the rest of our lives.
Oh, goody. I am excited.
Are you?
No. But
I'm not.
I am here for it.
You're
I
not
am
going
with
anywhere,
you, bud.
All right, bud.
No, I can't. I'm not supposed to. For good reason.
All right. Jason, you wrap it up. I just talked
okay.
a lot.
So you can find us on the internet. At this point in time, if you don't know where, then you just have not been paying attention, just like me. So remember, whether you're receiving messages over a 3-day span, or you are fervently writing down a stream of consciousness, you are
not alone.